Ways and Means for Wednesday, May 18th, 2005. Open a public hearing on SB 5527, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. Colleagues, this morning we are going to be spending about the next hour and 40 minutes on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and then we will go into the other bills that are here for a work session later today. Please proceed. Oh, Mr. Bender, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd just like to give you some information to start off your Phase 2 discussion of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission budget. And what I have done is I've distributed two items to you, one of which is a set of tables and information that has this on the cover, that bar chart on the cover. I also have distributed a copy of the excerpt from our analysis of the governor's recommended budget on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. In addition, you will find other documents. After I'm done going over this, the next document is from Mr. McGee, which is his presentation of the governor's recommended budget. And then you have a set of materials from the agency for their Phase 2 presentation. If you did bring your presentation binder from Phase 1, that would fit very conveniently into the back of that. But in order to sort of set the stage for this budget, I know it's been quite some time since you've discussed them in Phase 1, I wanted to focus a little bit on the general fund and lottery funds that go into this agency and to explain what those funds are being used for and what their budget situation is. This is the agency does not only operate with general and lottery funds. It also receives federal funds and other funds. And there are a number of programs that don't receive any state support dollars at all, including the private awards program, including the Aspire program. There are some other scholarships that are not state funded, as well as the Office of Degree Authorization has significant other fund support as well. So all of these are very important, and they will be discussed later today and tomorrow. But for my presentation, I'm just going to be focusing on the part of what the general and lottery funds are used for. And this first diagram shows you a little bit of history of the amount of dollars that we're talking about in terms of general and lottery funds. You can see the amounts there. The funding was pretty flat between the 99 and the 01-03 biennia. The 0103 biennium, of course, is the one that was affected by the five special sessions. And the fact that this amount was flat or went down slightly is actually, even though it went down, this was a significant effort by the legislature during this period of time to help preserve the funding level for OSAC. Certainly, if you looked at funding for other education agencies, they did not do as well between 99-01 and 01-03 as OSAC did, because the legislature did try to preserve the opportunity grant amounts. There was then a significant increase in 03-05, and both the governor and the Senate and the House, and I would like to start off by clarifying that for this particular budget, there is no difference between the House and Senate versions. This is the only budget that I'm staffing before you where there's, at least so far, complete agreement on the House and Senate side of what the budget is.
Just not agreement in the committee.
They haven't talked to the real important people.
We've got to solve that problem.
In other words, that was the short list.
But as you can see, the governor's recommended budget has a very large increase in support. It's basically 110%. It's more than doubled. And in the co-chair's budgets also has a very large increase. Compared to the governor's, it doesn't look so large, but it's actually 50% increase, which is, of course, a very large increase in any budget from one biennium to the next. But what I'd like to do is go a little bit more detail as to what these dollar amounts, what they really are, or what they really support.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Bender, I think at a couple of meetings ago, the chair asked Mr. McGee if we could get what is the governor's latest, or do we need to really concern ourselves with that?
I think the question I asked is, has has the governor compiled all of his potential revisions to his submitted budget? And I don't know if he has a revision here.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee from DAS. I've communicated the committee's request, and I have nothing to share with you today.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that for now. Yes.
If you go to the second page of my handout, this gives a little bit more detail as to where the state support, general fund, and lottery dollars go. Before going into this, let me speak briefly about the lottery fund dollars. These aren't your typical or regular lottery fund dollars. They're different in the sense that they are actually not the earnings of the lottery games. They are instead interest earnings on prior lottery game receipts. These are funds that have gone into the Education Stability Fund. That's the 18% that is dedicated by the Constitution of lottery proceeds that go into the Education Stability Fund. The corpus of this fund then earns rate of return as it's invested, and the interest, that return, 25% of those funds are dedicated by law to the opportunity grant. So the lottery fund dollars that you see in here are those particular dollars, and I've just combined them with general fund, which is what we do when we work on the budget, building the budget. We just combine the two. You can see that there are only four items that general fund goes to in this budget. By far, the vast majority of the general fund...
Yes. Sorry, I was a little slow. It's early earlier this morning. Could you go back to Mr. Bender and tell us, you said 25% of the lottery fund goes to the opportunity, is required to go...
Of the interest.
Of the interest on them. And
yes.
Is that in statute?
That is in statute.
What year?
What year?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I think it might have been the 99 session where that was established.
So
I can double check. It might have been 01.
It might have been 01 because it used to be the...
It's 02.
02 because we refer to the voters to change?
Yes. They approved the second version.
And that particular element was not affected by those referrals.
Oh, okay.
This is something that has been in place, I believe, since 99. But I will double check on that.
Yeah. It could have been in place for the previous endowment fund, correct?
It was.
Yeah, that's
it was.
For the previous endowment fund.
And I don't know, there might even be someone here in the room who knows.
We're getting some assurance from back there that it was 99.
Thank you.
Someone in the know.
And of course, as with any other statute, that's statutory, not constitutional, that provision. So you could change that if you wanted to, but not in this bill. You would need a substitute bill.
How much does that interest amount to?
That is estimated to be, the OSAC's portion is estimated to be about $760,000 this upcoming biennium. That number is down significantly. Back in 2001-03, it was about $1.6 million. But, of course, the corpus of that fund was transferred in many instances, in several instances, to help balance the budget. So as the amount in the fund went down, the interest earnings went down as well. But of these combined funds, most of them go to support the opportunity grant, which is shown on the first line of this table. The other three, there are two other support, scholarship programs or student aid programs that are funded by general fund. You can see the amounts for those, which are far less than for the opportunity grant. And the amounts, there's no difference between the funding for these programs in the governor's budget or in the House or Senate versions. These are two programs, rural health services and nursing services, that are available to repay student loans for medical practitioners working in qualified rural areas. I've listed the former Foster Youth Scholarship Program, which does not receive any funding This biennium, or is not proposed to receive funding. You did hear a little bit of testimony about that yesterday, and I typically don't list things that aren't funded, but because of that testimony and because in 0103 it had been funded, I'm still showing it there, but there's no funding for that program. And finally, there's agency operations. This is to support the staff work of the agency, and you can see the amounts there. In the governor's recommended budget amount, there was an amount of $2.4 million. The reason for this very large increase is the fact that as the agency has withdrew from the loan guarantee program, it had been relying on those program funds to finance a portion of the costs of running the overall agency that were shared between the loan program and the agency's other programs, such as the Opportunity Grant. Once the agency withdrew from the loan program, those source of funds were no longer available, and the governor replaced those funds after, of course, reducing the costs of the agency for the personnel that would no longer be working there and the functions they would no longer be doing, replaced those with general fund, and it resulted in about 180% increase in the cost of operating the agency. Both the Senate and the House co-chairs took $500,000 out of that in their rebalance of the budget. And you will hear today that the agency has found a large number of savings that indeed exceed the $500,000. So, I think we all know that both House and Senate chairs now will be interested in looking at those further reductions, but I can't represent them yet because they've made no comments yet on this. But under their budgets, they did take out $500,000 to reduce the rate of growth in the agency operation costs.
That $500,000 is reflected in the numbers that you have here. Is that
yes.
Correct? Thank you.
Yes. The next thing is, I wanted the big differences between the House and Senate versions combined and the governor's budget is if you look at the Opportunity Grant amount, it's $27 million less than the amount in the governor's recommended budget. And I wanted to explain what is really behind that by looking at the Opportunity Grant proposed by the governor and the Opportunity Grant proposed by the co-chairs. And the next chart, which is this very colorful table here, I've tried to...
Don't wake me up, Mr. Bender.
I've tried to explain what's going on here. And this compares the two budgets. And in this case, these diagrams are drawn to scale. Each little box you see there represents about $100,000, or not about, represents $100,000 of state support, of money for the Opportunity Grant. And if you look at the top chart now, if you look at the yellow at the upper left-hand corner, that's the amount of both state and federal support. Because we're adding the federal dollars, it's not consistent with the numbers you saw on the first page. But that's the amount of state and federal support for the Opportunity Grant this biennium. The total funding is $45.9 million. Everything else that you see in all these various colors to the right and below that are things that the governor added to that to get to a total of $94.4 million. So this shows the difference between the $45.9 this biennium and the $94.4 that would be available if you approve the governor's budget. And the way I've done this is as you add things to the right, you're basically adding new people to the grant program, people who would not have received grants otherwise. As you add things down below the yellow, you're not adding new people, but you're adding more dollars that each recipient would get. So you're adding to the size of the award, but not adding to the number of people who get it. So if I can just point out, if we, again, look at this top diagram and start with the yellow, I'm going to move to the right first and show the new people that are added under the governor's program. The first thing, which is very hard to read, is that yellow striped part that's just to the right of the $45.9 million. And if you look, you'll see what that said. What it actually says is EBL $1.4 million. That represents the additional funding that was generated as part of the state's calculation of what the essential budget level is. So in other words, if the governor only wanted to fund things at the essential budget level, he would have added $1.4 million to the $45.9, and that would have been it. That's approximately a 3% increase or so, and represents the rate of inflation that is in the budget process for special payments. Special payments are payments that go to other people. They don't support state government functions directly. Student aid are dollars that go out to other people. So under the EBL process, the increase would have been $1.4 million. So that's included in the governor's budget. He, of course, didn't even have to do that. Then the next item to the right of that is in blue. There was another $7.6 million added for what I'm calling cost and eligibility growth. What this represents is the fact that what we have in 0305 is a program that funds eligible students at an estimated 11% of the cost of attending their institution, and approximately 70% of the students who are eligible under the commission's criteria for eligibility are awarded. The other 30%, the funds run out, and they don't have enough money to do that. What this $7.6 million represents is the amount of money you would have to add above the EBL just so that in 05-07 you could continue to fund at 11% of costs and continue to fund 70% of the students, eligible students, who are out there applying. This shows that the program costs increased by more than the 3% that the EBL development allowed. If you look, you'd see that it basically increased about 19 or 20%. The question is, well, why is this program increasing in cost so quickly? Well, as tuition rates go up, the cost, 11% of covering the cost, is going up by more than 3% over a two-year period. We know that tuition is growing much more rapidly. And also, there's some enrollment growth in the system, so there are more students who are eligible. Basically, of this 20%, I think roughly about 5% of it or 4% is due to increase in the number of students, and the other 15 or 16% reflects the increase in costs. But together, you would need another $7.6 million not to reduce the funding amounts below the current levels. And the governor added that. I would like to state, once we've gotten this far, that if you sneak down and look at the bottom at the House and Senate, everything we've talked about so far is also in the House and Senate budget. So up to this point, they're identical. The next thing that the governor added is shown in red, and that is to serve 100% instead of 70% of these eligible students at the new cost level. And that, to serve those additional 30% that aren't being served now, he included $21.8 million. The cost is $21.8 million. And that's another element of why his proposal is $94.4 million. The next element is to allow part-time students to be eligible for an award for the first time. Part-time, currently you have to be full-time. This would allow, as long as you were taking at least half a load, you would receive half the grant that the full-time people would. And that expansion amounted to an additional $7 million, which is shown in green.
Mr. Bender, Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Mr. Bender, it's my understanding we have never funded part-time students under this program before.
That's right? My understanding, too. We certainly haven't recently. I believe it's never, but...
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, the statute has always allowed for us to fund part-time students, but the funding has never been provided.
That's what I understood. I didn't know about the statute part, but I did know we've never done it. And I just wanted to illustrate that for the record. All right, thank you.
Okay. So now we've gone all the way to the right. Now what I'd like to do is look at those things that are below the yellow. I'm still on the top chart, but these are some additional things that increase the award amount but didn't increase the number of students eligible. The next thing, which is shown in the tan color, the governor's budget included $5.8 million to increase the award levels above the 11%. So this would give each student more of an award than otherwise. And I've got some detail on that, what this really is talking about. If you look at the next page, the middle column, 0405, shows the opportunity grant award amounts this year. Again, all of these, in order to be eligible, you have to be a full-time student. So this is the amount you get. Community colleges, everyone gets the same amount. Oregon University System, everyone gets the same amount. And for the other independent institutions and OHSU, the amount varies, but is based roughly on 11% of the cost of attendance. If they continue this same funding mechanism for 05-06, this shows what the amounts would be next year. They are increasing because of the increases in costs. Now, I would like to say something about what this 11% means. 11% does not mean 11% of the cost of tuition and fees, because if you think about it, OUS, the average tuition and fees are roughly real close to $5,000 now. So if you only gave them 11% of $5,000, the award would be $550. It wouldn't be the $1,482 that you see is being awarded to OUS students this year. The 11% represents the 11% of a broader range of costs than just tuition and fees. It also includes certain costs of living that are standard, that are used in standard manner when student aid packages are created. So it's a broader sense of that. In terms of just looking at tuition and fees, the OUS award actually pays about 40% of the tuition for an OUS student, and pays about 45% of the tuition for a community college student. So, you know, if you're just looking at that basis, that's what the amount is. And for the, I don't know, for each of the individual independent institutions, it would vary, and I didn't calculate that for all of them. Also, one thing to note is that many of the students who are eligible for an opportunity grant will also be eligible for a Pell Grant, which is sort of like the federal version of the opportunity grant. And not all of them, but most of them would be. And if a student is eligible for a maximum Pell Grant, just to give you an idea of what's happening for that student, at OUS, for example, they would be eligible for $4,050. So a student that is this year who is getting an opportunity, who's attending OUS, is getting an opportunity grant and a Pell Grant, is getting the $1,482, or roughly $1,500, plus $4,000 from the feds, roughly. So they basically would be eligible for about $5,500. And again, tuition and fees at OSU for a full-time student average about $5,000. So the grants from those two sources more than cover the tuition and fees. Of course, there are other expenses to attending college that they don't cover. But I just want, you know, when people talk about 11%, I wanted to clarify, you know, what 11% is. And, of course, the Pell, it's not our program, it's the federal program. But those, you know, the students are, many of those students would be eligible for that as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Benner, when you talk about tuition and fees, are you including the price of books?
No.
Okay. The price of books is almost the cost of tuition these days. That's a little outrageous, but it is rather high. So there is a high cost. You know, what is the average cost of a student who takes 16 credit hours per term when you include tuition, fees, books, and cost of living? Because they do have to eat.
Correct.
And pay their rent.
You may be able to shed some light on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, for the record, my name is Margie Lau, it's Student Assistance Commission. The The number that you're referring to is what's often called the cost of attendance, which includes living expenses, including housing, and the formulas vary for students living on campus in dormitory housing versus those who are off-campus renters. But books now, most schools tell students to budget between $400 and $500 per term for their books, and then usually schools estimate that the cost of living, the room and board and incidentals, laundry and those sorts of things, are going to run students somewhere between $7,500 and $10,000.
For the term, for the year.
For the year, yes.
But it would be, since these grants, at least existing, are based on 11%, at OUS, if it's $1,482 on average, then we're roughly talking about $15,000 a year.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And being a parent of two college students right now, yes, that is about what's running me for each one of them.
You know, Mr. Chair, just I'm not going to be going home this weekend, so I can't go into the attic and get it out, but I'll try to do that next weekend. I still have a breakdown of how much I paid every term that when I went to school from 74 to 78 for my books and tuition and fees. And it would just be kind of interesting to pull that out of the attic and bring it here and share it with you.
So, Senator Walker, your attention to detail is not a reason.
I know. It's very scary. My husband wants me to go in the attic and start tossing things, but I still have my essays and papers and things that I wrote. It's bad.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would the good senator like to know how expensive her education was compared to when I went to school?
I bet you don't have the materials, to the supporting documents to back it up.
Mr. Bender, one area that you didn't cover yet is the one thing that, well, other than starting fully awarding to the full number of eligible students in the second year of the biennium under the Senate and House co-chairs budget, and also adding the part-time in the second year. One thing that the Senate and House co-chairs did not do is to increase the award amounts. And if you can go into that.
Sure. That is what, again, on this table here, you can see the 05-06 award amounts. Getting back to the tan in this colored table, the $5.8 million, what that represents is the cost of not awarding the amounts next year that you see in the right-hand column, but instead awarding for community colleges, instead of $1,323, increasing the award to $1,500. And for OUS, instead of $1,587, increasing that amount to $1,800. So it would be $1,500 for community colleges, $1,800 for OUS. And for the independents, instead of having an individual amount for each independent college, the governor's proposal would award $3,600 to every independent college student, which you can see for most of them is an increase over what would otherwise be the plan. But there are a few of them there, like Reed, University of Portland, Willamette, I don't know if I've got them all, I think I do, and also Lewis and Clark would also have less it being awarded. And those are some of the larger ones, actually, in terms of enrollment. But for many of the college, it would just be a $3,600 common one. In order to do that would cost $5.8 million, independent of all of these other changes. And Chair Devlin already mentioned, the co-chair's budget does not include that $5.8 million. So the awards under their budget would be the amounts that you actually do see here in this table for 05-06, which are not that increased, but they still are an increase from 04-05, because you can see there is an increase from 04-05. It's just not as big an increase.
Now, yes, Representative Jensen.
the Oregon Opportunity Grants applicable to only Oregon colleges?
Correct. These are all of the colleges where people receive the grants. So there are no colleges not on this list where there are persons in the country.
Is that statute?
Yes.
Clarification, Mr. Bender. In the governor's budget, since the governor assumed 100% of eligible students would be covered, and there's $5.8 million there for these potential increases, if you took the Senate and House co-chair's budget and you continued to cover, I believe it's 70% in the first year and then 100% in the next year, if you chose to increase them for both years, but 70% and 100%, it should be less than the 5.8, somewhat less.
Somewhat less, yes.
And then if you choose to make only the increase in the second year, it would be probably half of that amount or somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yes, roughly.
Mr. Chair, from the Student Assistance Commission, it would be a little bit more than that if you wanted to reflect the most recent tuition increases. Our grant awards lag a year in our increase because we can't predict that well in advance because of how late oftentimes the tuition setting decisions are made by institutions, what the awards will be. So we trail by a year that process.
If I could just wrap up now, please. This again, going back to this chart here, the colored one, that's the $5.8 million, and if you look at the House and Senate versions, that's not included. Another thing that's not included is a $2 million merit award supplement. This is an amount that would increase the opportunity grant awards for an estimated, estimated 2,000 students each year by $500. So their award amounts, instead of the amounts you see on this page or the 15, 18, 36, would be that plus $500. And the people who would receive this additional funds would be first-time awardees who have achieved some merit standard, perhaps having achieved a certificate of initial mastery or some other standard. They would be eligible for this additional $500 for 1 year only. Then if they continued on the second year, they still wouldn't get it under the governor's proposal, but the first year they would.
And Mr. Chair, and yes. Mr. Bender, they still have to meet the income guidelines to get
this,
correct?
Yes. Okay. So this is not new students. That's why I've shown it below. They're the same students that would get it otherwise, but this is an increase in the award amounts for a subset of the students getting the grant. Then finally, the governor's budget included $2.9 million above what all of these changes would actually cost. And the co-chairs do not include that either. The other change is opposed that Chair Devlin's already mentioned is, of course, the fact that the expansion in eligibility to 100% of all full-time and to essentially 100% of the eligible part-time is delayed until the second year of the biennium as opposed to the first. What this means is that the second year of the biennium, if you want to compare what the situation is at the second year of the biennium between the governor and the House and Senate, the same students would be served under both the second year, but the award amounts would be somewhat lower under the Senate and House budgets because they would not include the increase to 1,500, 1,800, 3,600. They would be the amounts shown in this column. And there wouldn't be the extra award for the merit.
One clarification, Mr. Bender. Going on the governor's proposal to 1,500, 1,800, and 3,600, do you understand the intent of that? And maybe Ms. Lowe wanted to comment also. Are we losing the... Obviously, the amount in some cases would be higher than the 11%. Are we losing to the tie to the 11% and we would simply be setting the number in the future for this grant? Or would we still have some tie to a percentage of the cost of attendance?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure which one of you you wanted us to respond, but again, Margie Lau with the Student Assistance Commission. The numbers that you have before you in terms of the governor's proposed award amounts come out to 12% of unadjusted cost of attendance. Right now, we do some averaging in order to come up with those figures, and we set some limits presently on how much of that we will cover. And instead, if we look at taking those limits off, it would actually cover, I said, 12% cost of attendance. So it would be uniform by sector in terms of the reimbursement rate. But the hope was, in the grant increases, was to be able to mitigate for what was happening in other places in the budget for what the tuition increases were going to be, to target the state's resources to those students who were the neediest, those who were most likely to not be able to attend given the other decisions that we're having to make elsewhere in the budget. By being able to focus on this group of students, we hope to be able to keep their participation in those school years and with this next year's entering freshman class. To give them that $300 increase in cost of attendance, as one of my student commissioners reminds me, if we fund only 11%, the student has to find the other 89% to pay that increase. By giving the grant award boost, we're funding the full amount of the increase for those students.
Mr. Bender.
I have nothing else unless there are further questions.
I have questions.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
And the last point, Margie, how many students are we talking about again?
Mr. Chairman, we're talking about, in terms of total students in full biennium, 66,000 students in total. That's a somewhat of a duplicated count because, obviously, we hope that those students are continuing year to year, and so there would be some overlap. But in addition to that, you know, it's that 30% that we heard from yesterday, those people who were eligible, but for whatever reason in terms of when they filed their FAFSA or when they got out of the military or when they were laid off from their job, whatever those circumstances, that they weren't working based on a school calendar at the point in which they needed to decide to go to school. And those people presently are out of luck for at least their first year of enrollment.
Just going to follow up on Mr. Render's chart here. The difference between 94 and the 67 is that's the 27 million. Okay. That's not a savings. That's basically they're just cost shifting that over into a tuition freeze. Is that where that money's going?
Well, the co-chairs had to put a budget together across the entire budget that would, balance the amount of expenditures with the amount of resources that were available. I do believe that was part of the thinking, but I'm not aware of there being an absolute direct connection between that. It was just.
I was just saying as I remember the co-chair's budgets, there was that $33 million shift in the tuition. And testimony that I heard yesterday basically was that at least that group thought that amount of money for tuition didn't really give you a good bang for the buck because it spread out over so much more. Maybe you want to comment on that. I mean, you get more bang for the dollars, I understand it, from the opportunity grant than you do the tuition freeze.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, that's certainly the view from the executive branch, the governor's office, the Student Assistance Commission, and the Oregon University system and community colleges. We all feel, given the limited resources of the state, that we need to focus on those students that is most important, that without this resource, they probably won't be in school next year. That's a lost opportunity.
Yeah. To Senator Nelson, will you complete her?
Well, I had one more question, but
Please go ahead.
This is a little bit different subject, but somewhat related. Is it back to this other chart? Basically, we're talking second year. We're going to have roll-up costs in the 2007-2009 session based upon this, about $27 million then.
Yeah.
So we might have the $27 million going to a tuition freeze plus the roll-up costs. So, I mean, I'm just looking down. We may not be out of this crisis in the next go-around, so we've got another $27 million there. Somewhere we're going to have to adjust things.
Part of the discussion on the tuition freeze There is clearly some sentiment that a tuition freeze would, in fact, benefit some students where the tuition increases that are planned by the governor wouldn't be that hard to bear. However, there's also concern expressed that opportunity grants are literally targeted towards the most needy students, which is probably most appropriate. But there are a group of students that are probably just above the level of being eligible for the opportunity grants, where increases in tuition and not being eligible for opportunity grants is going to be a prescription for making it much more difficult for them to attend. So that there is an element in there, you know, some people view the tuition increase will be benefiting some students that, just to reiterate again, that could probably bear the cost. And some people view the opportunity grant as going to the most needy and most targeted. But I think the Senate co-chair has some concern about those people that are just right above that level. And I think that goes to the discussion long term about not making the opportunity grants just a drop-off. You get to this point, you're either eligible or you're not eligible based on a very small change, well, based on a dollar change in income. And that's not probably the best way to run a system. So I just thought I could get the Senate co-chair's thinking.
And Mr. Chair, the commission is very aware of that, has done some modeling to look at different ways in which we might approach that. And, the idea is that not to give grants to or use the state's limited dollars to serve families like mine where the expected family contribution is $28,000 per student. And I'm going to have to admit that's a pretty staggering number when I do the arithmetic. It's not something that I really get excited about in a positive way when I fill out my daughter's FAFSAs. But I know that that means that's something I can afford to pay. But when we look at other families, those families that you're talking about that are just above that Pell eligibility or the opportunity grant eligibility, that's a tough place to be. And so we're looking at some of those choices, and we'd be glad to talk with the committee about some of those options for the future. And that's really why Tim Nesbitt and Brian are going to talk this morning about next steps for this program.
Any additional questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I had two. One, in response to what you just talked about, and I agree with you, there are children above that line that would benefit from a tuition freeze. But also we had testimony that about the tuition plateau and how Oregon State University has effectively kept that tuition level increased a very low amount. There's problems inherent with that. But the question I had for Mr. Bender is I need you to repeat for me the discussion you gave us about the undesignated funds in that gray area for $2.9 million.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really understand what that was to be used for. I mean, undesignated means it can be used for anything, would be my assumption. But please go over that again.
The cost of the opportunity grant proposal and changes that the governor brought forward turns out to be $2.9 million less than was actually included in his budget.
Okay.
What the governor included sufficient general fund to cover the full cost of his proposal. However, there are also these lottery funds that are available, and there are also funds from the federal government that are available and used for opportunity grants. Those two fund sources total $2.9 million above what the cost of the program is. You'll be hearing today that some of those federal funds, about half of them, do appear to be in jeopardy. So the full 2.9 may not be there. And you'll also be hearing that there have been other changes in the program. The Scholarship Commission has tightened eligibility requirements, which has freed up additional money as well that are not included. Those changes are not included in the governor's recommended budget or the co-chair's budgets as of yet.
That's an explanation I can understand. Thank you.
Mr. McGee, did you want to comment? Going into your presentation.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, Mr. Bender is accurate. The modeling for the opportunity grant changes didn't include the lottery dollars available or the federal funds dollars available. We will have an adjustment that will reduce the general fund based on the availability of lottery funds and half of the federal funds, which we think we'll get, and not the other half we're not going to get. So we think we just reduce that federal fund expenditure limitation. So, with that, if I could proceed with my presentation.
Yeah.
For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services, just going through some of the numbers fairly quickly. The Student Assistance Commission represents about 1% of the all funds education program area budget of $11.7 billion. It represents, again, about 1% of the general fund and lottery fund education budget of $6.5 billion. Programs really fall into three of the governance principles. Most of it's, as you'd expect, in the education principle. The rural health and nursing services programs are in the health principle, and the Office of Degree Authorization is included in the government efficiency principle. In terms of where the money comes from and goes in this agency, about 85% of the budget, or $94.8 million, is state general fund, primarily for the opportunity grants, Mr. Bender indicated. There is other funds limited of about $3.9 million, and other funds non-limited about $9 million. The sources of the other funds' revenues are grants and donations for private awards that are received from a variety of different sources. There are about 320 of these private scholarships now. The money that actually goes to students is the non-limited portion. The money that's retained for administration under the agreements with the donors is shown in the other funds' limited budget. The Aspire program, the agency receives money from the Oregon Community Foundation, the Ford Family Foundation, and federal AmeriCorps grants, thank you, to support that program. There are transfers from a couple of agencies that help support programs. Bird funds are received for that scholarship program from the Department of Education. The Office of Degree Authorization receives several different types of fees to support its functions. The federal funds, as we've talked before, are referred to as LEAP and SLEEP. That's Leveraging Educational Assistance Partnership and Special Leveraging Education Assistance Partnerships. Those dollars have been zeroed out in a recent congressional budget resolution, so we're assuming that we will not receive those in the second year of the biennium, but the money's fast-forwarded, so we do believe we'll see it in the first year. And as Mr. Bender indicated, the lottery funds, which are about 1% of the budget, represent the interest, 25% of the interest earnings on the Education Stability Fund. Excuse me. In terms of the different program units, 97% of the budget is in the Grants and Scholarship Program. 1% is Information Systems, 1% in Office of Degree Authorization, and 1% of Administration. In the future, you'll probably see just the Administration Information Systems combined. It made sense when there was a loan program here, but since that's gone away, there's not really much of a point to retain those as separate units. So we'll change that in the future. In terms of how the funds are spent, 94% of the money goes out the door to special payments, in this case payments to students to assist with their educational expenses. 4% in the governor's budget, about $4 million is budgeted for personal services, about $1.8 million for service and supplies. Mr. Bender indicated you'll see some significant reductions as we went through the governor's budget. We've been able to reduce those pretty significantly as we move forward. A major change here that we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about really was the elimination of the loan program. That was a very large piece of the agency. It supported the infrastructure of the agency, and as it was eliminated, it's actually still being eliminated. There are still some of the legalities that are being worked out. We tried to decide how the agency was going to be functioning, and we've been able to continue to reduce the administrative costs as we've done that. Here again are the numbers with the governor's budget adjustments that we'll be talking about in a moment. As Mr. Bender indicated, the general fund will be up about $107 million, 107% after we've changed those. And the total funds is down 7.7%, which really shows you the impact of the elimination of the loan program.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Bender, do we have the breakout of these positions like we've been getting on the other agencies that Senator Wissett ask for?
We do have, we don't have that particular, all of that information, but we do have information on where the positions are and what the changes are in their organization. Let me look for that while Mr. McGee continues his presentation, and I'll get that to you.
Thank you. In terms of policy issues, we've talked about the increase in the opportunity grant funding by 110%, and I won't go through the details of that. I think Mr. Bender's done a very good job of that. We are maintaining most public scholarship programs at the current levels. Mr. Bender indicated the Rural Health Services, the Nursing Services Program are directly supported with general fund in this budget. The Military Department's Tuition Assistance Program receives both federal funds and other funds, and the remainder of these programs are supported by different federal and other fund sources. We'll be continuing those through the biennium. The other policy issues are House Bill 2079 would eliminate the Deceased and Disabled Peace Officers Program, which duplicates federal and state benefits. There's both a federal program that pays for post-secondary education costs for these officers and their dependents. There's also the Public Safety Memorial Fund, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training budget that pays for these benefits. So we're asking for a change to remove them from the opportunity grant funding stream. There is no fiscal impact on that because the dollars come directly from the opportunity grant. And as an indication, those tuition for those students are paid at 100% of cost. So they are higher on a per student basis than you'd see for the opportunity grant awards. There's a reduction in private scholarship expenditures of $11.8 million, other funds non-limited. The Ford Family Foundation has made a determination it will distribute its own grant awards directly. The OSAC continues to deal with much of the administration, the upfront piece of those awards, but the foundation is actually doing the distribution. OSAC will continue, as I indicated, to administer over 320 private scholarship programs directly. We have a package to expand the Aspire program by $600,000 roughly, with, again, the donations from the foundations and the Federal America Corps revenue. And we're proposing you continue the Office of Reauthorization function at current levels. As I indicated, with the elimination of the loan program, this agency has lost 61 positions from the 2003 biennium. It's now down to, with our adjustments, 23 positions. So it's been a very, very major reduction in its funding. Other funds have been reduced by $12.2 million, and other funds non-limited by $29.2 million, all related to the administration of the Federal Loan Guarantee Program. We have had to replace some of those funds for the agency operations to be able to continue it as a standalone agency. The governor's budget shifted $1.6 million of cost to general fund for the grants and scholarship program, the Office of Reauthorization, Information Systems Administration. Part of our reductions, we have, in the governor's budget, we retained 17 positions in the grant administration program. Those will be reduced to 14 in the adjustments I'll talk about in a minute. The Office of Degree Authorization, which at one time also contained a policy research unit, has been reduced from 6 positions down to 2. Information systems has been reduced from 6 positions down to 3. And administration for the agency has been reduced from 10 positions down to 4. So there have been very significant reductions in the overall structure of the agency as a result of the loan program, as well as the positions that were directly related to administration of the loan guarantee functions. We also have a package that would shift $37,000 to other funds for the Oregon Financial Aid Exchange, or OFAC, system. These would be supported with revenues from the colleges and the universities that use the system. As I indicated, there are some adjustments we're making to the budget. We're proposing that you reduce the opportunity grant by $2.6 million. The first part of that, as Mr. Bennett indicated, there has been a change in the eligibility criteria. We don't simply look at cash income. The agency is now looking at assets as well, and that resulted in about a $740,000 reduction in general fund for the next biennium. The issues Mr. Bender referred to as undesignated funds, as we talked about, the Education Stability Fund revenues were not considered in the cost modeling. That's about $761,000. And the federal LEAP and SLEEP monies will be available only for, we're also not included, we're suggesting you could reduce $1 million of that because we will continue to receive those funds in the first year of the biennium. So those would allow you to reduce the opportunity grant by $2.6 million and still continue the model that the governor has proposed. We're also requesting that you reduce the federal funds expenditure limitation by $1.1 million. That is the second year of the LEAP and SLEEP funding, which, again, by congressional resolution, we don't expect to continue. So without those funds, there's no need for the limitation for them. As I said, we've been able to look at the agency administration following the termination of the loan program, and where we had asked you to appropriate $1.6 million general fund to continue functioning the agency, we're now able to reduce that by almost half and suggesting you can reduce $765,000 general fund and still continue the agency's functioning as a separate standalone agency. We've also taken a much closer look at the other funds, revenues that we'll be incurring. These are primarily the grant and scholarship program, and are asking you to reduce the other funds expenditure limitation by $421,000 and eliminate three positions which are currently vacant that we just don't have the revenue to be able to continue to operate. And that concludes my presentation.
Any additional questions? Yes, Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are doubling the nursing services program, or more than doubling. And is that number at 358 expected to meet demand, or is that projected above?
Mr. Chairman, Representative March, this is a program where we have more applicants than what we have funds to support.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, unfortunately. So if there were added resources, then yes, there would be more students who are interested in this program that we could provide that assistance to. And I'm sure there, with the nursing crisis that we have across the state, that the issues in the rural areas continues to exist.
Thank you.
Ms. Lowe, we will be going till about 9:45. You have Mr. Clam and Mr. Nesbitt both here. How much time will they need?
Mr. Chairman, I think their presentation will take somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes, depending upon the number of questions and interest from the committee. So I would propose at this time that we switch to their portion of the presentation, and then we can pick up and start with the regular agency presentation after that.
Okay, that would be fine.
Just click on this one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, speaking as a member of the State Board of Higher Education and co-chair of our Access and Affordability Working Group. I want to make a few comments on the decisions in front of you in regard to the Oregon Opportunity Grant and how it relates to the whole challenge of affordability for our higher education system. I'd then like to make sure Brian Clem has an opportunity to comment as well. The longer presentation, which we were invited to bring with us today, and I want to make sure it still fits with your agenda, I don't want to presume that it does, speaks to a longer-term framework for addressing and accomplishing what we want to accomplish in terms of making and keeping a higher education affordable in Oregon. And it basically gives you another yardstick to work with besides just chasing the levels of support that we see is provided in other states. You get those measures from these biannual reports called Measuring Up, and we keep getting an F, and we keep showing you how the dollars we're committing to programs like the Oregon Opportunity Grant are far below the dollars that other states have committed. But the report that you're getting from our work group as well as the slideshow we have here to share with you if you want to take the time to do that, gives you a longer-term framework for saying how we might not only commit the dollars we think we need, but structure them and structure the program in a way in which we think is best suited to accomplish our purposes. And if I could...
Yeah, Ms. Nesbitt, we actually have the time, plan on spending 25 minutes to go through this portion of the presentation.
Okay, thank you. And if I could at the outset call your attention to one other question, which I think has been raised already in the hearing, and that is the whole question of the relationship between tuition, which you're dealing with in another budget, and support, namely the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I would like to share with you that the discussions we've had in our work group and at the higher ed board suggest a middle ground between freezing tuition and perhaps not committing as much to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and the proposal as you've entertained in the governor's recommended budget, which had tuition increases of 5-7% in the first year and 5% in the second year for the Oregon university system. The middle ground could be looking at a limitation on tuition increases not to exceed the projected growth in median family income. And that way we know we're at least staying even with the ability to pay generally in the population. And then if we were able to put more dollars into the Oregon Opportunity Grant, we'd be able to target those dollars more to those to whom the cost of attendance, mostly tuition, is the greatest barrier to attendance and completion. So I would just want to kind of continue to highlight that whole question as a policy question, and I know you're struggling with it. With that, for the design of the shared responsibility model, I'd actually like to call on Nancy Goldschmidt to present that, but before I do that, I want to make sure Brian Clem can present what he has to present.
Good morning, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Clem. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And I'm not going to take a long time because I know that hearing some of the work product about the long-term plans or what's slated for the agenda, but I did want to just make a couple quick comments because I'm not going to be here tomorrow due to a family commitment, so I'm not going to enjoy the benefit of your company tomorrow. The thing that I think you need to keep in mind about the agency and then about the Opportunity Grant is that this agency has went through a drastic change. And in my mind, at least, in the minds of the Commission, this has been a difficult but positive experience overall because we really believe the work of government is to try and expand opportunity. And we were in a student loan guarantee business that really was better served by the private sector. So in exiting that business, one of the things are more than 50% and stakeholder work group reiterated was you ought to use this as a way to accelerate your energies into grants and scholarships, that loans shouldn't be the primary way people finance their college education, and your responsibility as an agency is to go out and try and make loans less necessary. And so the work of the commission to basically get out of the loan business, and then the work of the access and affordability work group that the governor then listened to and capitalized on in his budget has led us to this place where we have a much leaner agency that is far more and far better suited towards targeting grants and scholarships, which should be the primary way we finance education in this country and certainly in the state. So I want folks to keep in mind that piece, that this is a positive turn of events really in the scheme of things for our agency to have a more focused mission and not trying to do several different things, none of which particularly focused because we had so many different activities. And the other piece is just the background on where the governor's budget came from, because the agency went and did roughly 8 public hearings all around the state on 2 different topics, and every time we did a public hearing we heard about the need to fully fund all eligibles and to expand into part-time students. And we heard it Medford, Grants Pass, Pendleton, Portland, Salem, LeGrand, Bend, always the same thing. You need to fully fund all your eligibles and you need to include part-time students. Then when the Access and Affordability Work Group started its work, they worked with members of the public and members of the different education sectors and came up with some additional things that Tim's going to share, some of which we've implemented already, like the asset test, where we found folks who had too high of assets, really, to be in the pool, and we corrected that. The other things that members of the voting population that we worked with said is you ought to have some incentives in your program for doing well, for achieving higher while you're in high school. You ought to do something for them. So that's reflected in the governor's proposed budget. I know it's not in the co-chair's budget, but the members of the public that we spoke with in a focus group felt it was important that you try and incent people to work harder. And then the award amount growth that is again, the reflection of a unanimous sort of end of a civil war for the last decade between all the different educational sectors that, again, I see not adopted in the co-chair's budget, but that's a really big deal in terms of what this committee has had to deal with over the years, where we've went back and forth between the privates and the public, and we finally have an agreement, and I would love to see that back in play, because it's certainly something that would make it a lot easier on those of us trying to do your work on your behalf in the interim to not have to navigate the warfare between the different sectors on the budget level. Having said that, those are the main pieces I wanted to get across to you, and I'll let Tim and Nancy go from here. No, that's fine. Yeah.
As Nancy Goldschmidt, who staffed our committee, comes forward, I do want to call your attention to the report we just distributed and to page 3 of that report, which summarizes the recommendations of our working group. And I think for the most part, these can be grouped in short-term, mid-term, and longer-term recommendations. But in particular, a lot of what you're already dealing with this morning in terms of items 1 and 2 are addressed in both the co-chair's budget and the recommended budget you have. Also, if you look at item 3, that's where, as Brian Clem mentioned, OSAC is starting to take into account family assets. And if we move more towards the Pell Grant model, we'll deal with what Senator Devlin has pointed out is the cliff effect we now have, where if you earn an extra dollar of income, you're going to lose all of your eligibility, as opposed to the sloped effect of the Pell Grant, where as you earn a little bit more money and you're in that middle income group, it's still a challenge to cover the cost of college, but you get a little less help, but you still get some help, and there's a phasing down. And that is one of our recommendations for the middle term as we move into future biennia to try and accomplish that kind of structure. Longer term, again, we're intrigued by the shared responsibility model developed in Minnesota. It's based on both individual effort, recognizing that a college education provides individual economic success as well as collective economic prosperity for our society when we're successful in that area, both individually and collectively. So with that as a starting point for a longer-term view here, I'd ask Nancy Goldschmidt to share with you what was done in Minnesota and how we're looking at a model, a framework that could work for us longer term as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy Goldschmidt. I'm Associate Vice Provost, Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm here speaking to you as lead staff member for the OUS Access and Affordability Working Group. It's pretty clear to me that you know the importance of the opportunity group, opportunity grant. So I won't go over the F in affordability and why we have that. The personal income of our residents is quite high compared to our tuition and fee levels. Student borrowing is very high, and our educational system is increasingly stratified by social class, that students from lower incomes and increasingly moderate incomes cannot afford to go on to college. And we ask you, what's happened to the belief that any American could get to the top if they worked their way through college? Upward mobility has been something that we all believed in, that if you worked hard, you could achieve it. And we know that income has been flat since 1975 to 99 for a student, for people who have a high school diploma or less. It rose substantially for those with bachelor's degrees, and it skyrocketed those for advanced degrees. We've got a paradox here, I think, that we need to resolve, and that's what makes it very difficult. On the one hand, increasingly people are believing that the benefits accrued from a college education are private ones. You earn more income, the higher degree, and for certain kinds of fields, and yet at the same time, a more highly educated workforce is regarded as necessary for Oregon's economy to be more competitive in the global economy, develop our traded sector industries, and reduce costs of social programs. These are seen as public benefits. And we've already mentioned the first step that we recommended was adjusting the Oregon Opportunity Funding, Oregon Opportunity Grant funding base. And what we want to do is look at this design for shared responsibility that was adopted in Minnesota way back in 1983. It's regarded as one of the most innovative programs. And one of the things it does is balances the notion that it is a private benefit, students need to provide a lot of self-help, and that the government will step in when assistance is needed. So it views students and families as having the primary responsibility for paying for post-secondary education. It believes that financial aid should expand access and choice, and that the disproportionate burden of the increase in tuition and fees and books, which is also astronomical, is on lower income and moderate income families. So paying for college is viewed as to be shared by three components: the family, the student, and the taxpayer if required. The principles for shared responsibility include identifying a recognized price of attendance, and that includes the actual tuition and fees at public universities, tuition maximums at private and independent institutions. So they're capped off because the private and independent institutions tend to have much higher tuition and fees. And then what it does is sets a standard living and miscellaneous expense allowance by the legislature. And what this does is it says, we recognize that, and they've got about $5,200 is what we're going to give you for living expenses, room and board, things like that. You are going to make individual choices about where you want to live, whether or not you go on vacations, whether or not you do anything else, and that's your responsibility. So it does set a parameter around what the legislator's what the government's responsibility is, and the legislature there sets the spending living allowance every when it feels like it needs to be adjusted. It regards the student as a primary beneficiary, and it regards the family and public and state as secondary. All students, regardless of income, are expected to invest in their education. So it treats all students the same, whether they're wealthy, moderate, or low income. It views every student as needing to make some commitment for their education. They set that as 46% of the recognized price of attendance. And the reason it's set at 46% is they felt that college prices have increased faster than wages. 54% then would be the family government kind of component, which is the slope that Tim talked about. So then the student responsibility varies directly with price. If a student chooses a lower cost institution, their responsibility is lower. If they charge a higher priced institution, their responsibility is greater. So it's important for the student and the family to sit down and figure out what they can afford. Students then can draw upon past income, current income, and future income to pay for their assigned responsibility. One of the expectations is that students will work in the summer 40 hours a week, and they will. Most of our students now work part-time during the school year, and we know that if they work 10 hours a week, that it doesn't harm their educational progress. So we estimate that to be about $2,500 left for college after taxes and living expenses working at a minimum wage job. The remaining 54% is assigned to families and, if necessary, taxpayers. And so this is based on the starting point for determining family responsibility is the financial need analysis used in the federal Pell Grant. It takes in income and assets. It specifies an estimated family contribution based on that. And then it determines whether or not the taxpayer should make a contribution, the government. Minnesota, up until 2003, had an educational savings allowance sheltered up to $25,000 net worth to encourage college savings. In 2003, because of budget cuts, they eliminated that. So taxpayer responsibility, if there is determined to be one, is met by coordinating government programs. They count the federal Pell Grant first. And it's already been mentioned that for the lowest income students, that Pell Grant is a little bit more than $4,000. Its average is about $2,500. It leverages other taxpayer federal contributions. And they have an estimator that's absolutely really fascinating and cool. If you have time and you want to play with it to see how it works, you go online. You enter some simple income information and asset income information, and in real time it pops up how much you should be expect to get from Pell, whether you're eligible for the federal HOPE tax credit, work study credits, veterans benefits, all those things to figure out what the family is really going to have to pay. Then the state taxpayer contributions come next. And at the end of the site, it links the student to the institution they indicated they were interested in the beginning, because that affects the tuition and fees that were identified, into the website for the institution to get them to start talking with the institution about possible scholarships and grants and other work study that might be available to them. In Minnesota, they have a broader spread of their grant, state grant program across more income levels, up into the moderate income levels, which Director Nesbitt has mentioned is something we thought was really important for the Oregon Opportunity Grant in the future. This kind of lays out an example of somebody attending University of Minnesota Twin Cities, a student in a family of four earning $41,000 with two children but only one in college, and a renter. The estimated price of attendance is $13,881. The assigned student responsibility share is 46% or $6,385. The assigned family share is $1,219, and that comes from two sources, from the federal and state. And then the estimated government grants are nearly $7,000, with $3,400 coming from the federal Pell Grant and $3,539 coming from the Minnesota State Grant. And here's a case where Minnesota has decided they want to do more than the federal government for this income level student. That is not the case in Oregon, where our opportunity grant represents about one-fourth of the maximum Pell Grant for community colleges and four-year publics. And then a HOPE tax credit. So what they're doing is providing education to people to say, take this HOPE tax credit. Here's how we would project a student would meet their responsibility. $2,500 in income. Private scholarship of $2,000. And here's where we think it would be really important to leverage partnerships. And I want to give you an example of, and this is a Minnesota example, but I want to give you an Oregon example. There are some employees at Nike who've established Marathon Educational Partners. They are kind of like adopting, mentoring students in the Portland area. They are contributing $1,000 minimum to the College Savings 529 plan, which Nike matches. And they begin saving for students when they're in third grade all the way up to high school. The students are encouraged to put birthday money and other kinds of things in there to help. So there are some sources and new opportunities for that. Institutional grant, $1,000. And then the loan amount is down to $885, which is considerably lower than the current average, about $3,500. So what we're trying to do is not have students so deeply in debt when they graduate from college, because some students will go to become teachers and social workers and other things that don't make high incomes, like engineers, computer scientists, physicians. So I think that the design for shared responsibility provides a basis to look at some key components and then go into further kinds of examining. It would take a long time to think about what's the right percentage for Oregon. Is it 46%? Is it lower for student responsibility? Is it higher? What are the revenue sources needed to meet the slope that's out there, and how can we build on partnerships? So I think there's lots of conversation that still needs to happen if this is a model that makes sense to people. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
If I could add one thing, looking at this chart, and if you look at the next to the bottom line, the Minnesota State grant of $3,539, this is a middle-income family with $41,000 annual income, pretty close to the median family income, very close to the median family income in Oregon. They're getting assistance from the state of $3,539. Currently, under our Oregon Opportunity Grant, they get zero at this income level. I think that's key comparison here.
Yes, Mr. Bender.
Also, it might be interesting to note that the tuition and fees of $8,600 are also about $3,500 more than what it would be in RUS. So it's kind of a
launch. One of the things that happened when they first adopted this in 1983 is they went to higher tuition levels, more differentiated tuition between their national research universities and their regional universities. In the Oregon University system, the tuition and fees, although they're starting to spread, they're pretty close together. So they tried to do that in exchange for having more opportunity grant money and using the Minnesota grant, using that as a way to buy more access for students who needed the resources to go to college. Without the resources, they can't afford this high price. But some students can. I'm done.
Mr. Chair, I mean, how far away are we from being able to implement this? I mean, you're intending to reuse some of this opportunity grant to do that?
Well, this is part of the longer-term recommendations, Senator and Mr. Chair. We're thinking we would have to continue in a working group in the interim between now and the next session to kind of bring you back a recommendation that we think works for Oregon. This is the framework. A lot of the assumptions and particulars would have to be examined more carefully, and so we think it's another project for our work group. Whether it stays constituted as it was in the past, it definitely will take some more work during the interim between this session and next to bring you those recommendations.
The Minnesota program started in 1983, so it's a very successful.
It is very successful. It's regarded as very innovative, because I think it balances both a more conservative perspective that people ought to provide some self-help to get to college, compared with the beliefs that everybody ought to be able to go if they've done the right things, and financial needs should not be a barrier.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes.
Mr. Chair, for the record again, my name is Margie Lau with the Student Assistance Commission. I would invite you as members of the committee to take page 12 in the presentation that you just saw from OUS, and I have some percentages I'd like you to put on the pie chart there that would give you what the current Oregon Need Grant program with the Opportunity Grant is doing. So if you were to take again this pie chart page, and in the category that's the 20% category, if you would pin in there 32%.
I'm having trouble finding it. It's this one here. Chart number 10, which is on the second, the back of the second and last page.
What category is that? These gray shadings.
So the less than 10,000 category,
okay,
which for Minnesota is 20%, that would in Oregon be 32%. The 10,000 to 20,000 category, that where in Minnesota it's 19%, in Oregon that is 16%.
Pardon me.
16. And in the $20,000 to $50,000 range, that is 50%. And for the over $50,000 group, that is 0%. I think it's important for you to be able to see where is our program at presently compared to some of these other models that we'll be exploring across the country. The other thing that one of the things that we have to be mindful of as we operate the program, presently we operate the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program with about three staff positions. Support obviously from the IT section, the information technology section, and 1.5 policy staff. We need to look at these other models across the country in terms of also the administrative efficiency because, as we understand from our counterparts in the state of Minnesota, they have quite a bit more staffing required to operate that. So we would want to explore models that capture the important principles but also keep a focus on administrative efficiency at the same time.
Questions from the committee?
So if you would like at this point, we'll turn to the stated agenda. There are a number of things that we received instructions as an agency that we needed to cover with the committee. And this is going to seem, I think, rather dry in comparison to some of the other things that we've talked about this morning. In terms of what are the budget drivers, I think you've heard a lot this morning about what are the budget drivers for the Opportunity Grant Program. I seem to have a frog. The program that we have in the past has been driven by a lot of federal policy. It was really federal policy that caused the changes that occurred in the student loan program. Changes. Thank you very much. Changes in the Federal Higher Education Act over the last decade changed how student loans were administered. They also changed how higher education is administered generally. There's a lot of discussion going on at the national level about proposed changes to the Pell Grant program. The President and Congress, we think, will probably increase the Pell Grant by $100 for students in the current federal fiscal year. But the Pell Grant has been frozen for a number of years because of underfunding situations that Congress was facing. And so Pell Grants have been at a maximum of $4,050 for a number of years. That affects college affordability all across the country, including here in Oregon. So we need to be mindful of that environment. It also is the legislation that affects what happens with those federal SLEEP and LEAP programs and a number of other student assistance programs like the GEAR UP program that provides assistance to students in middle school and then on into high school to prepare for post-secondary education. And also the Bird scholarships are also in that. Enrollment trends obviously are a tremendous driver. The decisions that you make about what's going to happen in the Oregon University system and the community college systems need to be reflected also in the Student Assistance Commission. It affects what that cost of attendance is going to be, as well as the number of students that we would hope to be able to serve. Or, of course, are affected by overall population trends as the number of young people increase or decrease, and also the changes in our economy that have really, I think, changed who we see on college campuses today. When I was a student, about the same time as Senator Walker, the college campus that I attended had mostly 18 to 20-somethings as a student body. Mm-hmm. A person who was over 30 was either a professor or a graduate student. We just didn't see that. And I think yesterday you saw a new cross-section that's represented on our campuses. People need to be lifelong learners, and our educational systems need to update in order to reflect that changing dynamic about who needs to learn and how they need to learn in Oregon. What's happening in the K-12 system also has a tremendous impact on the Student Assistance Commission. And we see this really reflected in what we're hoping to do in our expansions of the Aspire program. This program is helping more students and families prepare their young people for post-secondary education. Yesterday you heard from one of those volunteers from Sheridan High School. She herself had very strong grades, could have gone to college, but didn't know how to get there. And what we don't want to have is that same kind of dilemma being faced by our young people who are in high school right now. One of the things we know as a society is that students need to have dreams that they feel are achievable for them to stay focused on being a strong performer, for doing the best they can all through their educational process in order for them to be the most productive and successful students once they finish that high school education. It makes what happens in that high school much more viable and pleasant for everyone who's there, but it also prepares that student to be a much stronger contributor once they get to college, if that's where they are able to go, and then once they complete their degree. That readiness is really what we're focusing on with the Aspire program, but we also need to work in partnership with what's happening with high school counseling and education services all across the state. Unfortunately, in what's happened in the K-12 system, those systems have become very thin and fragile in many places. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm not going to cover a lot of the history for the Student Assistance Commission. In the last decade, which is the time period that we were asked to address, the agency's changed its name. In 1995, we were known as the Oregon Scholarship Commission, even though our services spanned a much broader context. In addition to that, we were still operating the student loan program. That was just about the time the Higher Education Act changed, which really created the dynamics that led us to the decisions that needed to be made in the last year. That is probably the most dramatic change that has occurred to the Student Assistance Commission, is our decision to exit the student loan program. We are about to conclude our negotiations with the federal government and with the Educational Credit Management Corporation that will allow us to exit that program with the elimination of what was $6 million of pending federal audit liabilities. We will not be required to repay those pending disputed amounts. And also in a way that those 61 positions that were mentioned earlier in Mr. McGee's presentation, only six of those people are actually drawing unemployment today. We really worked very actively with our staff to place them in other successful employment in order to reduce the cost to the state and the hardship to them and their families. There have been a number of studies that have been done about what kinds of tuition assistance programs Oregon needs to operate in that last decade. And in fact, statutes were changed Senator Devlin and Mr. Bender talked a little bit earlier about the creation of the Educational Endowment Fund, which became then the Education Stability Fund. These were mechanisms where people recognized the importance of investing in higher education for needy students. Unfortunately, the economy of the state created a lot of difficulties in our ability to achieve that. That same study group that looked at that as an option also passed statutes that are as dormant on the books right now, unfortunately, as that part-time student grant program is, and that was to allow us to be able to make some awards based on merit. That was hoped to be implemented in the 2001 session. Not the most fateful of years, unfortunately, for Oregon. So that program also has been something unrealized to date. In the most current biennium, we also have continued to strengthen our partnership with the Ford Family Foundation. As Mr. McGee referenced in his presentation, we have changed our relationship where we are handling more of the front-end processing of the applications. The Ford Family Program really wants their applicants to be students who are applying not just for their program, but to apply for every opportunity possible for those students across the state. And so if perhaps a student is not selected for the Ford Scholarship, which is a really wonderful program, they still have the option to be selected in one of the other 320 programs. So it's really a wonderful opportunity where students can apply through a single application for all of those. And because of that, many of our donors are interested.
Slow, this might actually be a good time. I do not know actually how long the items that we have remaining on the agenda today will take. They might take 15 minutes. They might take all 45. How much time will you need tomorrow? Could you get through your presentation in 2 hours tomorrow? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I can tailor it as the committee wishes, and if there are certain things that you're more interested in than others, certainly fold that feedback into how I structure what I share with you tomorrow.
Well, why don't we plan on 2 hours tomorrow, and I will move the committee tomorrow to 8:30. So we'll go from 8:30 to 10:30 tomorrow. And I hate to cut you off at this point, but we've got about three small budgets and a fee bill to get out of this committee before we go into our bicameral
budget process.
Certainly. We'll be glad to see you tomorrow morning at 8:30, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll leave a couple minutes for... I don't think that the majority of the people in the room are going to be that interested in the presentations that are coming after this, although I do not want to make it.
Senator Devlin, yes. If I might, could I make one additional comment?
Yes, yes.
This may be my last session in front of this body as a volunteer in the commission. I think I'm 6 years into my term, and I'm not sure I'm going to make it to A with all my other life that I need to get back to. But on this question of tuition versus the grant, I'm a believer in low tuition as a policy for the state as well. But I think back as a poor kid from Coos Bay who was waiting for a financial aid letter to be the decision on whether I could go to college. A tuition freeze at that point wouldn't have done me any good if on my letter it came back and said no opportunity grant. Because if, there was a couple hundred dollars in tuition that I didn't even know about, I had no idea what the rate was going to be. But that letter showed up in my mailbox and said zero in the opportunity grant column because I was unfunded. I was one of the 30%. I just wouldn't have went to college. I'd still be in Coos Bay. I wouldn't own a business. I wouldn't help run our orchard. I'd still be in Coos Bay waiting for a mill to reopen someday. Yeah. And that's what you have to think about with this tuition increase. And I think you may be able to find a middle ground, a compromise, but we really need to make sure that all the eligibles are funded.
You can also be cutting abandoned dunes, too,
What's that?
You
can
be cutting abandoned dunes.
Yeah, a lot of the mill workers down there are doing that now. That's right. They're caddies.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Klim, thank you. I was a poor kid from Reedsport, so I can relate.
Thank you.
Are you cutting abandoned dunes, too?
No, I'd like to.
We all should have done the same thing. Yeah, you're not cutting it.
This goes back to your starting time, sir. We, I believe, got instructions we're going in at 10 tomorrow on the Senate.
Are you going in or in the House?
I mean, in the House. Sorry.
So I take over.
I used the bad word.
Well, Ms. Slow.
We're back to 8 o'clock.
We're back to 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock.
We are here to serve, Mr. Chair.
This means the Senate will get a half an hour off from 10 to 10:30.
There you go.
I was looking out for us. I appreciate that.
I was hoping I could move with age period.
Harder for you.
But a couple of days. You have a normal ID here.
I don't know. There's a somewhat large.
I didn't bring all these notebooks down. No, we didn't need them.
You won't need them? Did you bring the recommendations
that I have no idea.
I don't know.
Okay.
Just vote yes. You know, I have all these notebooks on my sofa.
I wasn't that impressed.
I know. I just happened in every nook and cranny rather than on the big.
You have one extra set.
They should not have been picking him.
Okay.
Nor the, we can send the name. Larry
can.
I don't believe so. We have one extra set for you, too, to share down there.
Okay.
I'll just take center ward. I always take center ward. I never vote no on any of those.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Did you vote no on that? Chuck,
you need to get that.
Yes, I
at least.
Okay.
You know, if we take this for this one. Take 12.4 million.
Close the hearing on SB 5527. We're going to go right down the list. Open a work session on 5010 and 5009.
Okay.
Ms. Nancy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. House Bill 5009 and 5010 are the budget bill and fee ratification bill for the State Board of Local Workers. Yesterday I distributed my recommendation packet. The packet includes a memo, the work session action report, and a performance measure listing. In the interest of time, I thought we would just go through the memo. The memo basically summarizes the change when we get to the budget bill. Summarizes the changes between the governor's recommended budget and the legislative fiscal office recommended budget. Starting with the fee bill for the State Board of Clinical Social Workers, 5010 ratifies the fees that were increased administratively during the biennium. The agency discussed during their public hearing, they restored their fees during the current biennium back to the 1997-99 level. They previously had been trying to manage their ending cash balance and had reduced them and then increased them up to that level. The table in the memo shows you which fees were increased. The fee increase generates almost $122,000 worth of revenue for 0507, and it is needed to support the budget. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the fees be ratified. I do have some proposed amendments to the bill because currently as the bill's written, it includes proposed fee increases for 0507, and we need to just get those out. The agency will bring those back to you next time when they actually administratively increase those fees. I could get a motion to approve.
We have, but we need a motion for the amendment first.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the LFO amendments to the LFOs to House Bill 50, House Bill 50, Ken.
Okay. Are there any objections? Okay. And then okay. Some of this is a little bit interesting because of the situation that we're in. So there's no objections to those amendments. And Representative Jensen, are you moving House Bill 5010 be amended and reported out due past as amended?
I would, if the amendments are now included in the House Bill 5010, as far as the committee here is concerned, I would move House Bill 5010.
That's what I'm saying. That's the normal way it ends.
This is a House bill. I assume it would move out to the House Budget Committee.
Yeah. Sure. So it's actually moved out with the due pass as amended. Is that correct?
As that's corrected. Correct.
Any objections?
Mm-hmm.
Hearing none. We'll move on to 5009.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 5009 is the budget bill for the State Board of Clinical Social Workers. I'm going to talk about the policy packages as well as the technical adjustment package that we put in. You'll see this in most every budget that comes before you. Package 801 is the LFO technical adjustment package. This package reduces the governor's recommended budget by $4,408 to reflect the PERS rate reduction and in the attorney general rate reduction. We're also recommending that a few line item shifts just to more closely align the budget with actual spending.
Mr. Chair, clarification.
Yes.
Is House Bill 59 and the LFO recommendation?
No.
This is just the bill.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would move House Bill 5009 to the House Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
Can I ask a favor, Representative Jensen, because it's been undecided what happens with these bills after this. Can we just move it out with a due pass? The problem that we have is none of the bills that are in full ways and means are actually in either House or Senate budget committees right now.
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, if these budget bills get passed out of a joint committee, then they will be amended to two different budget bills, and they will go to the House Special and the Senate Special Budget Committee full, and they won't have to go through a subcommittee process because you've passed it out of a joint committee. And so,
okay, so
actually, just passing them out with a due pass recommendation is sufficient.
Mr. Chair, I would amend my motion. If we move House Bill 5009 out with a due pass recommendation.
As amended?
Are we amending the amount?
Are we amending the
amount? What is the amount then with the $4,408 off?
I hadn't gone through all of my recommendations
yet.
But if you just like to skip to the bottom line, that's okay with me.
Okay.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Then,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends another funds budget of $569,955, three positions, and 2.5 FTE, and that House Bill 5009 be amended accordingly.
So moved.
Yes. Would you like to talk about performance measures?
Yes.
I have recommendations on those as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the agency reviewed their seven performance measures, two of which are new. They're the standard customer service measures. We're recommending that performance measure number five be deleted and kept internally. In other words, it's a good measure, and it'll be good use for agency management, but it doesn't necessarily need to be reported to this body every biennium. We're also recommending approval. The agency requested that performance measure three be deleted, and we're recommending approval of their request to have it deleted.
Representative Jensen, you had moved that the legislative fiscal office recommendation for the budget be approved. Does your motion now include moving that the legislative fiscal office recommendation on performance measures be approved?
Mr. Chair, that is my motion.
Discussion on that motion?
Yes, discussion.
Mr. Chair, I've been trying to write a memo for weeks, and you know, the pressures of this building sometimes are so great because I'm in committee all the time. But one of the things that we discussed, you and I passed a note one day, and I discussed it on the record, was getting a performance measure in some of these, with some of these agencies to require them to look at training of their staff, of the people who are licensed through them on mandatory reporter training for sex abuse and child abuse. And you had asked me to write you a memo. It's halfway written in my computer, okay, which does us no good today. So how are we going to address that to get these into these agencies? And this is a, this is the first example of that. The clinical social workers who are mandatory reporters.
One of the things that we could do, Senator Walker, mm-hmm, is I have already discussed the potential of a budget note in terms of DAS, in terms of training, or, well, not training, but DAS doing more, since it's going to become the more responsible agency in terms of providing basic services to some of these, to actually provide some services in relation to best management practices for smaller agencies. But I think we could do something similar in this, or we could also direct, I have to think this out, some way for the various entities to come back and to propose amendments to the performance measures to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, which has the authority to approve changes in measures during the interim.
There might be another way around the tree if the question is maybe not just performance measures, but actually getting the training out there. We could recommend the AG do it through, I mean, there are, although these agencies have AG fees, which presumes contact with the Attorney General's office, and yeah, and this seems like appropriate training to be conducted by them.
Yeah,
they do know how to do it, and you're right, Representative March.
The only thing I would say, Senator Walker, is I think you and I need to work on this in all due haste, because I do not know how much time we have left. Even if we have 2.5 months left, that's not a lot of time to get something inserted.
Why don't you and I then have a discussion outside this meeting, so that we can kind of hammer out some idea and bring it back to the committee with some thoughts about that.
Okay, we can do that.
But, that's why I ask, if we're going to pass out these budgets, then how do we get the performance measure in these? That's my concern.
And I think the question, we can try to address that after the budgets pass out, and we can probably do that
in the full budget committee?
In the full budget committee, but we could also do it in the sense of some direction with some of the agencies and have some responsibilities for these agencies.
Okay.
So,
I don't want this to drop. I think it's so important, and we had testimony that they agreed.
Okay.
From at least, I think it was these folks, the clinical social workers.
Yeah.
Counselors and therapists, I think.
Counselors and therapists.
But, Mr. Chair, perhaps the budget report could reflect that direction, that the agency work on a performance measure and bring it forward.
Be the easiest one.
Mm-hmm.
That actually is something we could, Ms. Nancy is absolutely right, we could put that in the budget
report.
Mm-hmm. In the case of all three of these agencies that are before us today.
Mm-hmm.
Because they all have some of that sort of core relationship to some of the issues, well, in terms of who the clients are of the people that they license.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that they that might be just a one way to deal with it, and then we can follow up on that and make sure that it happens.
Yeah, I'll try to finish my memo today, Mr. Chair, because it's going to the Senate President as well, asking that all of us get trained before we leave this building. And the problem with the reporting statutes is they cover, like, they're all over. There's, like, four different areas in the statutes because they cover elder abuse, child abuse, sex abuse, and abuse of persons generally. So those all would have to be cited in the budget note, and I have all those cites.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
For you and Senator Walker, I was on judiciary during interim, so I learned about this requirement. And I had a case where a constituent called me on Friday at 5 o'clock and said, I think my daughter is being abused by her, my ex-wife's boyfriend. And my concern was trying to notify the people that, and to get my responsibilities documented. And that's a real problem. And I talked to DHS about this. Because then as freshmen this year, we were also reminded of a responsibility to, as legislators, to report any suspected sex abuse. And so I've worked with DHS, and they still don't, to my satisfaction, there's no way when you report it that you have something back to you saying, I've reported it in a timely manner.
Mm-hmm.
I was worried all weekend that, you know, something would happen to this young girl, and there'd be no documentation that I reported it, although I called DHS and tried hard to get it in the system or be sure that they were acknowledging that I had fulfilled my responsibilities under the current statute. So when you're looking at that, there's some work that needs to be tweaked on that as far as documenting or giving you a, okay, here's your acknowledgement number that you reported in a timely manner. Because I was really, you know, as a concern that, you know, something terrible could happen to that young child over the weekend, and I had no record that I had reported in a timely manner.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Wisner, I think that's a very valid point, and I'll add that to my memo. And that's why I think as we get down to the end of session here and some of our committees have shut down and we'll have a little bit more time in the day, that I think that we can get that kind of training and have those questions answered and understand what our job is as a mandatory reporter. It's quite one thing to put it in the statute, and it's quite another thing to actually implement the statute and do what we're supposed to do. So for now, am I to understand, Mr. Chair, that we will put it in the budget note for these three bills,
yes,
and then you and I will have a discussion about...
we will put it in the budget report,
that
they are supposed to come back to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and propose a performance measure.
Okay.
And we can... The motions that are on the floor now are to approve both the budget and to approve the performance measures. Are there any objections to those motions? No. Okay. I'm going to hand this over because it's easier to do this way. Representative Jensen will become my motion.
Oh.
We're at the final motion there.
Okay. I move House Bill 5009 be amended and reported out do pass as amended.
Thank you very much. Are there any objections to that motion? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Quick.
Open a work session on 5017, the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists.
Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 5017 is the budget bill for the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. Again, I did distribute a packet of those three documents. The memo details the recommended changes, primarily the PERS and Attorney General. Rate reductions reduced the budget by $4,290. Almost said $1,000. The policy package, position reclassification package, is recommended to be approved. It's reduced again by the PERS reduction. The reclassifications are needed in response to increased workload and increased responsibility. Department of Administrative Services has determined that the reclassifications are warranted. The biggest change, and although it appears to be a policy package, is an adjustment that the Department of Administrative Services has requested to this agency's budget for $78,188. Again, we are recommending approval. Basically, what this does is adds into the 0507 budget the effects of two emergency board actions that that were approved for this agency during the interim. The need was in response to increased costs related to complaint investigations, and they've procured a new licensing system. We didn't have a lot of time when the agency was presenting to talk about the status of the new licensing system, but nonetheless, it has been procured, getting noddings in the back of the room, and therefore that does have ongoing costs in 0507. There is some concern about the agency's projected ending balance for 0507, and so one of the things I was hoping that the budget report could reflect was that the agency would work closely with the Department of Administrative Services through the execution of this budget and monitor revenue and expenditures just to make sure everything was okay as we move through. Because the projected ending balance is the minimum needed. It's about 9.4 months. Which is about the minimum given the agency's renewal cycle. So if the revenue doesn't come in as projected and they spend at the rate that's been approved, they could have a little difficulty. Unless there are any questions about the packages, I could read my recommendation.
Okay. Chair, if you read your recommendation.
Thank you. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends an other funds budget of $551,744, three positions, two FTE, and that House Bill 5017 be amended accordingly.
Mr. Chair, I move that the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendations be approved.
It's been moved that the budget portion of this be approved. That will include the comments that Ms. Manfrey made about some of the issues long-term with the agency, and also will include some of the issue relative to a performance measure on mandatory reporting. Are there any objections to that motion? Hearing none, motion passes. We'll go on to performance measures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are 10 performance measures as submitted by the agency, two of which, again, include the standard customer service measures. Several of the measures, Measure 4 and Measure 7, are recommended, and number 8, excuse me, are recommended to be deleted but kept internally. Again, similar to what we discussed with the clinical social workers, these are good measures for their internal management but not necessarily needed to be reported to the legislature. They also had a customer service, two customer service measures. Those are recommended to be deleted to be replaced with the standard customer service measure.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I have questions. Yeah. I understand we're deleting performance measures 4 through 8.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move that the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation be approved regarding performance measures.
It's been moved that the LFO recommendation relative to performance measures be approved. Are there any objections to that motion? Hearing none, the motion passes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move House Bill 5017 be amended and reported out, do pass as amended.
Members of the committee have heard the motion. Are there all in, is there anyone opposed to the motion? Hearing none, the motion passes. 5017. Once work session is in. Open a work session on 5524.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 5524 is the budget bill for the State Board of Psychologist Examiners. Again, same packet that you had before, and I'll quickly go through the memo that outlines the technical adjustments as well as the recommendation on policy packages. The technical adjustment package will reduce the governor's recommended budget by $11,503. This is for the PERS and attorney general rate reduction, as well as a methodology rate change in the Department of Administrative Services, Human Resource Services Division. state government service charge calculation. It was requested by the Department of Administrative Services, and therefore we've put it in there for them. There are three policy packages. Package 090 is the Smart Buy Savings, $1,279, and an adjustment for current biennium underspending. We recommend approval. Package 100 is to implement Senate Bill 59, which has passed, and it allows the board to implement alternatives to the current oral examination required by statute. We recommend approval. And Package 101, Workload Management, this package allows the board to increase its part-time investigator to full-time. And I think the agency has done a good job of demonstrating what they can do in terms of improving performance related to investigations. And I think it's they've done a good job doing that. We recommend approval of the package. However, I have reduced the package by $9,217, which is corresponds to an increase in services and supplies that they had requested. It looks like, based on current spending, that they should be able to absorb those costs. So the new package total is $30,750 and approval of the 0.5 FTE increase.
And your recommendation?
Is another fund's budget of $703,707, three positions, three FTE, and that Senate Bill 5524 be amended accordingly.
Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I move that the LFO recommendations for Senate Bill 5524 be approved.
Everyone has heard the motion. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the motion passes. Performance measures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The agency has 10 submitted performance measures. Again, it includes the two standard customer service measures, which have been added. There are measures 5, 6, 7, and 8 are recommended to be deleted, three of which to be kept internally, again, for similar reasons, that they're good measures, but they don't need to be reported to us, to you, excuse me. And actually, measure number 6 was the agency requested it be deleted.
I have a chorus over here, 5, 6, 7, 8, who do we appreciate? But
Okay. Are we ready?
Yes.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move that the legislative fiscal office recommendation for performance measures be approved.
Okay. The performance measures have been moved to be approved. Is there any objection?
5, 6, 7, 8.
We think it's great. With no objections, motion passes.
I move Senate Bill 5524 be amended and reported out, do pass as amended.
It has been moved that Senate Bill 5524 be moved out, do pass as amended. That includes the recommendations that have been stated by Ms. Manthe, and includes the language to direct them to prepare a performance measure on mandatory reporting to the Joint Legislative Committee Audit Committee. Are there any objections to that motion? Hearing none, motion passes. 55 close. Committee, we will be back at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Whoa, I thought it was 8:30.
It was going to be 8:30, but then the House decided to go in it.
Did you let Margie Lau know that?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll see everyone for a potentially final meeting tomorrow at 8 a.m. Representative Jensen, we were working so well together.
I don't think this committee's been the problem.
I don't know.
You got that right, Representative March.
Are we
done?
Off the air?
Yes.